So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardawar, and I'm joined by Senior Mobile Editor Chris Velasco.
Hey, Devendra, how's it going?
Hey, Chris. And yeah, we kicked Sherlyn out for this week because she's on vacation, and I
she's
want her to take a
break. Much-needed break. My goodness.
Oh, man. And I'm sure Sherlyn is just, like, in her room staring at solitaire or something, so... Bless Sherlyn. Everybody send her your relaxation vibes and wishes and everything. This week, we're going to be talking about the iPhone 12 and Chris's iPhone 12 and 12 Pro review. We're going to dive into the crazy Among Us stream by AOC and Ilhan Omar and kind of what that means for the future of democracy. People playing, you know, murder games online. That's fun. And we'll chat a bit about the death of Quibi, which sort of happened as we were planning this episode. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes in particular. That's very useful. And if you have any questions or if you want to just chat with us, you could drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We typically record live around 10 a.m. Eastern on Thursday, so you can join us there for some live Q&A, and we'll show off some gadgets when we have them. Okay, Chris, I'm putting the ball in your court here. I've read your iPhone 12 review, the iPhone 12 Pro review.
That you had to
Well, here's the thing. I was very excited going into reading your reviews, and I think you did a good job of like conveying what's new and what's different, but also the fact that this isn't really a huge change from last year, right? Like, what are your major takeaways from these phones?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head that time. As I sort of note in the introduction to my review, like, on paper, this seems like a really momentous time for Apple, right?
5G!
They've got 5G. They've, like, sort of normalized the iPhone design across basically all of their devices. You've got really incredible new performance with this new the A14 Bionic chip based on that 5-nanometer process. Like, this seems like a big year for Apple. But after using the phones, I really walked away with two ultimate conclusions. One, that the iPhone 12 and the 12 Pro are really not that different, which is great if you're shopping on a budget, because the 12 is more than enough. And that just generally, if you have an iPhone last year, and maybe even from the last 2 years, you there's no huge rush to get out there.
Right. I have an 11 Pro right now, and I'm looking at this, and I see no reason other than maybe the slightly bigger screen. But the camera, nothing really has changed other than the processing side of it. Same lenses, same everything otherwise, right?
So we've got LiDAR in this year's Pro, which I think is really interesting. And to back up, this is a component that was introduced in the 2020 iPad Pro. And when it was announced, I think just about everyone who heard about it was like, what are you
Why?
Doing?
On a tablet,
Exactly, right? Like, augmented reality, if it tends to happen at all, tends to happen on phones. So why start here? But, I mean, I think that ties really nicely into what we sort of know Apple really cares about, augmented reality. There have been rumors for years that Apple has been investing really heavily in it. They've had ARKit, this really comprehensive set of developer tools to let people create augmented reality experience. That's been around for 3 years. They use augmented reality really extensively around their campus, the visitor center, the Steve Jobs Theater. There's constant rumors that AR goggles are like a thing for Apple. So clearly, on some level, they see their trajectory as a device maker as relying very heavily on that. And LiDAR,
they've been hiding AR in things all over the place too. Like, I think in the event invites, we found little cool AR objects, like cool things like that. So
for sure,
it's weird. Yeah, they're leaving stuff all the way around.
Yeah, but the thing to keep in mind about Apple is that they have just such incredible reach that something like LiDAR, which stands for light detection and ranging, long story short, it's really fast at sort of identifying and judging how much space you have around you.
Right.
Something like that, if you have the ability to just kind of force that on people and by extension, force that on developers, give them that tool to work with, this really kind of feels like a watershed moment for Apple and AR. But for now, it's hard to tell what kind of impact will have, because I don't know. There's like, do you use augmented reality apps at all? Like, I don't.
If I'm looking at like furniture from like IKEA and stuff, and any like Amazon often has this, in Best Buy, where you can view a 3D model of something in your living room just to get a sense of the size and the scale. I've used that and it's worked pretty well, but I'm sure LiDAR would make it even better, right?
That's the idea, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there, in my experience at least, it's mostly just faster at identifying the space. You know, whether or not the things that you like hang on your virtual walls or stick on your virtual floor, whether or not those persist better, really kind of boils down to how good the developers are. But I mean, at least in theory, what's nice about the LiDAR here is that, yes, there are tools for developers to tap into that new array specifically. But even if you don't, even if you're just running on pure, like, standard Apple AR kit, you get to – your app benefits from that LiDAR. Like, it just works better without you having to do anything.
That's kind of cool. And I could see it being useful for something like maybe eventually Pokemon Go or Minecraft Earth, where you are, you know, traveling the world and looking for actual virtual objects in spaces. Like, – that could be great, although I wonder like how that'll compare to like the Android versions of these apps. Like, we're at a weird point now where some of these things have to be standardized because AR and AR understanding needs to be like the new HTTP, right? Like, everybody needs to be on the same ball of how they do it. I think what really struck me about your review, V, is that the iPhone 12 just seems solid. And it seems solid in a way that the 11 did, like it didn't last year. It seems like there is less of a, you know, real difference between the 12 and the Pro this year.
Absolutely. And it's a weird thing to kind of keep in mind as I went into this review, because I really liked the iPhone 12. It was one of those devices where you knew you were getting some compromises, but like at the end of the day, you still got great performance. You got, you know, exceptional battery life, which is unfortunately no longer the case here. The thing about the 12 is that, the differences between that and the Pro are so minute most of the time. I mean, realistically, the big omission for the 12 compared to the 12 Pro is that you don't get that telephoto camera, you don't get that LiDAR, which is fine. I mean, like, I will always take a more flexible camera setup when it's offered to me.
Is the ultra-wide more useful to you than the telephoto?
Always. Yeah. Because the way I think about it is, if I have the option of moving forward to just like get a better vantage point of a subject, I will do that.
With
ultra wide, that's not like you can never move around enough to capture the same amount of space as an ultra wide can. So in terms of
ultra wide is super useful for like especially kids and tight spaces, because we just bought my daughter a tiny little playhouse to sit on our like in our backyard. So that's for her birthday. But when she's in there, if I don't have an ultra wide lens or anything, like I can't capture her in the space, and that's annoying. And I think parents would appreciate that flexibility. Yeah.
Actually, really quick, happy birthday, Sophia.
Thank you. Yeah, like, she's great. She's doing great. She had a birthday in the park. I wish that the world was not on fire so she could actually have friends over, but she really enjoyed it. We got her a Totoro cake and she loved it.
Ooh, you've introduced her to the Ghibli canon very early.
I have. Like she is on board with Totoro, Kiki, Nausicaa, which can be a little scary sometimes, in Castle in the Sky, but you know, she's doing well. But basically, ultra wides, I think that's what parents want, because as much as the telephoto lens is useful, it's sometimes a little slow, especially if you're doing portrait mode. Like, kids move fast and they move around a lot, so you're not going to get the most out of that telephoto as you would with the ultra wide, I'd say.
No, for sure. Practically speaking, you get a good wide camera, which the 12 and 12 Pro have. Like, the standard 12 megapixel wide camera is excellent. If you get one of those, you get the ultra wide, you're covered, I would say. I mean, and this is a number I'm kind of pulling out of nowhere, but like 95% of situations, you are good. The telephoto it's nice to have, but I can count on, you know, two hands the number of times I've taken a telephoto photo and just really, really liked what I came away with.
Yeah, I like the flexibility, especially for video. Like, I like hopping between the different sizes of lenses. And also, again, for baby stuff, like sometimes it's good to follow my daughter and like do the zoom when she's a little further away and then come in closer. But yeah, I don't think, and not everybody needs it. And you still get good portrait mode, right? Because you still have two lenses on this, on the 12.
The portrait mode is quite good. I will say that mm-hmm. portrait mode can be a little better on the iPhone 12 Pro. And that's because of the LiDAR, actually. Yeah. So when you're in low light situations, the LiDAR, Apple wouldn't confirm whether the LiDAR is trying to do its thing all the time or if the phone can tell it's dark and then turns on LiDAR, which is a fine distinction to be sure. But like, would be nice to know. Turns out when you're shooting in low light, especially with portrait mode, it uses the LiDAR to like quickly shoot out light and get a sense of where the person is and where the background is. So you do get slightly better night mode portraits, which is new this year on the iPhone 12 Pro. I tried it with our social media kid. I guess he's the head of social media, but I call him the social media kid, Mike Morris. We got some really fresh shots that I wish I could show you, but probably should have mentioned that beforehand.
there is that. One thing too is that the addition of LiDAR and, you know, all these lenses we're seeing in other smartphone cameras now, what the gulf between, you know, a point and shoot camera or even like a small mirrorless camera and the smartphone camera seems really to be, it's being erased in a way. And even a good mirrorless will not have some of these features, right? Like in some cases you're better off taking photos with your smartphone, especially when it comes to low light, right?
I mean, that's definitely something we've seen happen over the last few years. The idea of computational photography, right? If you buy, you know, something nice, like a Sony, I don't know, like A6500, whatever, like the nice sort of entry-level mirrorless camera is now. You buy one of those and you can get great lenses for it and it's smart enough to do autofocusing and tracking and all of that stuff really well. But there's a limit to the amount of processing you can put between that lens and that sensor and what you see.
And you need to know how to work it too, right? Like that's the thing. Whereas if it's like sunset or the lighting is weird or it's really dark and there's a bright element and you're trying to capture it all with these cameras, you kind of need to know what you're doing. And even the auto modes aren't that smart about it. Whereas with a phone, you just point it and most phones, a Pixel phone, the iPhone 12, will just get that shot in a much better way, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, smartphones and the iPhone in particular this year is the, I mean, they've replaced point and shoot cameras. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone, but just when you think about the amount of processing power that sits between that camera and your screen, like you're capable of getting photos with no effort on your part that looks so much better. They would have taken considerable setup had you used an SLR or a mirrorless camera, which is really cool. But at the same time, there's a question of, you know, artistry versus just having something offered to you. I don't want to like swing too hard in the wrong direction, but I reviewed the Xperia 1 Mark II earlier this year, which has a crazy camera sensor and a bunch of pro modes. And it's legitimately not the easiest thing to use, but I do love some of the photos I took with that phone more than I do the iPhone 12 because I feel like I earned those photos.
Yeah, I feel that. It's the difference between like instant photography versus like, you know, professional and manual stuff where you're really choosing your film and dialing in your settings and everything. Anything design-wise you want to call out from these phones, V? Because I do like the look of them. I like that you and I have both talked about this. The iPhone 5 design, like that super thin, flat edge. To me, that was like a great, that was a good case before all this other stuff that followed. And we're kind of back there now and I'm digging it. I think it's a good look for these phones.
I'm a huge fan. I mean, you and I have talked about this a lot. We are in the same boat. What I like about this phone in terms of design is that it feels very modern. It's obviously inspired to some extent by the iPad Pro redesign. But it does have sort of a nostalgia kick to it. Like, I do really feel like I'm picking up like the best phone that I used when I was a little bit younger, just sort of updated for today, which I think is really cool. I should point out a couple other things with respect to design. First off, the designs, aside from like the camera and the materials used, are basically identical. If you buy one of Apple's iPhone 12 cases, it works for the iPhone 12 Pro and vice versa. Like, they've standardized that in a way that seems to make a lot of sense. But I don't know. We'll kind of see how that goes.
That wasn't true last year, right? Like last year, the 11 cheaper in a way. Yeah.
I'm really glad you brought that up because the iPhone 11 in so many ways was a step down from the flagship phone of that year. And that was fine because you were getting it for less money. It was, so the iPhone XR, I believe, launched for like $750. The iPhone 11 was $700 to start. So you were getting it for less money, but you got the great performance. You got a so-so screen and kind of a chunky body, but you were okay with it because it was a new phone that ran well. This year, because they've sort of standardized the design across both the 12 and the 12 Pro, you just don't get some of the benefits that come with that chunkier design, like that bigger battery.
Sure. But you get OLED now. You get an OLED screen. You get I think, a more sturdy looking design than the 11 last year. Yeah.
So this is a huge matter of taste. I really prefer how like thin and light this thing is now. But our security guy, remember security guy Jose at the office? Mm-hmm. So I was shooting at some photos and video at the office, and he came out and wanted to sort of catch up because it's been a while. And I showed him, and he's an iPhone 11 guy, and he picks it up and he's like, you know what, man, this is really nice. The screen's beautiful. Really like this. iPhone 11 feels more premium because it's got that heft to it. And I'm sure he's not the only person who feels that way. So there is a distinct difference in palpability. Like our social media guy, Mike, also sort of commented, is this thing made of plastic? Like there is a real gulf there that I think a lot of people who liked the 11 because it had that sort of weightiness to it, you're not going to get that here. And that might be a little disappointing.
You know, so the 12 is aluminum and the 12 Pro is steel. Is that how it works?
Yes. Yeah.
So that's kind of a big shift there too. Have you played with the 12 mini yet? Because for me, that's the most interesting new phone they're releasing. And also because that is starting at $700, they pushed up the price of the 12, right? So the 12 is now starting at like $800.
$800 or $830, depending on where you buy it from. And I've still, by the way, not gotten an actual valid answer from anyone about why that thing costs more some places.
There's some weird deals going on between all the cellular providers. And
There's some backdoor stuff happening here.
Yeah,
for sure. The 12 mini is no, we've not tested that yet.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to it just because there's been over the years such a dearth of really good small phones, right? Some of the Xperias were tiny and those were nice. Arguably, like the Pixel 5 is pretty small, even though it has a 6-inch display. It's in like the same general size ballpark as the iPhone 12. But I can't think of a great small phone. The Palm, I guess, if you're a sadist and like don't care about your life.
It used to be, so even with what they did with the SE2, like small phones usually meant a step down. It meant budget. It meant cheaper hardware. Do you have a sense of how much smaller the 12 is compared to the 12 mini is compared to the 12?
So I'm like not off the top of my head, but I do know that roughly speaking, if you sort of pull out all of the recent iPhones, the iPhone 12 mini is bigger than the original iPhone SE, which is based on the iPhone 5 design, and smaller, I believe, than the new iPhone SE, which is sort of based on the iPhone sort of 7/8 design.
But it has a screen that goes all the way. So you're getting more for that size. Yeah.
You're getting more. You're getting a considerably faster processor kind of across the board. Yeah. You're getting really full flagship performance out of maybe the most pocketable new iPhone we've seen in a really long time.
I love it. I am looking forward to buying that one for my wife soon because she's on Android. And my goal this year is to get her over to iOS eventually. And I think a small premium iPhone is kind of the way to do it. So I'm looking forward to that. Do we know when is that's shipping a little later, right? That's not till November.
I forget the exact date, but it's going to be early November. It goes up for pre-order. Then I believe, I think our pals might have been talking about it in the chat. So the mini won't be released until November 13th or so.
Yeah.
And I believe that's the same time that the Max is coming out. So we're really seeing an interesting exercise in contrast here.
Seriously. And by the way, the Max, I didn't realize this during the launch event, but the Max is where the Pro camera stuff gets better. The actual 12 Pro is not getting some of the best stuff that the Max is, right?
Can you break that down? Absolutely not. If you want a Pro iPhone, like you really do have to wait for the Max. Not only because we're expecting better battery life, just because you can squeeze a bigger battery into this display or this body. But you've got, I believe how it breaks down is it's the 12 megapixel wide angle sensor, the standard camera. That is considerably, I think it's bigger. So you're able to capture more light and sort of get more data for the sensors and the computational photography stuff in the background to work on. You get a slightly better telephoto range, which is nice.
It's like 2.5x, right?
Yeah, you get 2x optical on the Pros now, which is nice. But like when you test as many devices as I do and you see a Samsung do like 5x optical, no problem. Yeah, is that a gimmick? Yes. Is it a useful gimmick? Also yes.
Sure.
And then we're also getting a new image stabilization system, I forget exactly what Apple calls it.
But I'm very annoyed. I'm annoyed that should be in the 12 Pro. The 12 Pro Max, because it looks like, just like last year, it's a big chunky boy. It's a bigger screen, but also still like weighs 0.5 pound. And I don't want that in my pocket. It's too much.
Well, I would I would caution you to be like, what's weird is that the gulf between the iPhone 12 and the, sorry, the iPhone 12 Pro and the 12 Pro Max this year should be a little smaller just because there's less stuff around the screen. So I'm expecting a device that is not quite as big as the 11 Pro Max that I used to use regularly.
Sure,
and I got to say, the 6.1 inch display on the 12 and 12 Pro, that is a sweet spot. Like if you're coming from the iPhone 11 Pro Max with that 5.8 inch screen, this is going to feel big enough that you, unless you really care about that camera, you're probably not going to sweat that screen at all.
Sure, you're
right where you need to be.
So we haven't talked about the killer feature, the thing Apple kind of baked everything around is 5G, baby. And it's this is a weird year to be launching into 5G, but your thoughts on the performance area? It seems like they added this because they had to and because so many other phones did and because there are a lot of 5G phones in China and elsewhere in the world. Like Apple had to compete, whereas what they did with LTE, if you remember, right, is like the iPhone 4S, that was the one where everybody was expecting them to add LTE. Was it? Yeah, it was the 4S. But it was still, that was actually slightly faster HSPA. It was still slightly faster 3G. Mm-hmm. We didn't get LTE until the iPhone 5. And I think that delay was actually good because the LTE phones originally were bad, like the HTC Thunderbolt and everything. Like they were not good. They were chunky, no battery life. Is the same situation seems like the case for 5G, but Apple jumped right into it, which is surprising.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Historically, Apple has never really felt much of a need to dive right into this. I mean, like, think about it. The original iPhone launched with Edge when 3G was, like, starting to become a thing. Like, they probably could have made that work if they wanted to. And they were late to the LTE shift as well. And so if you look at that track record, it's easy to surmise that Apple just, like, we'll invest in something when it's ready. But I think this year, given all of the conversations, all of the hype, for good or for bad, and given just the amount of head start that Android phone manufacturers have had with 5G, it seemed really necessary to get something out this year, which is why they made the deal with the devil, Qualcomm in this case, you know, to get those 5G modems running in their phones. Obviously, Apple would like to rely on outside vendors as little as possible. And we're fairly sure going forward that they're just going to have all of their own in-house modems baked into their iPhones. We're expecting that shift to happen going into next year. So It seems like their backs were up against the wall. They needed 5G stuff out there, if only because it would look bad if they didn't. So they gave us 5G. And you know what? 5G is fine. Like, this is not the first 5G phone we've tested. We started trying out 5G networks, I think, like last year in Chicago when Verizon launched 5G millimeter wave there.
And full disclosure, we're owned by Verizon. Yes. Yada, yada, yada. But
But the thing about 5G is that, depending on where you live, your experience will have, like, Devendra, I guarantee that if you lived back where you live just a couple blocks away from me, we'd still have completely different coverage experiences. Like, it's definitely wild. And it really depends on who your carrier is, where you are. So Verizon, we were given like a Verizon test line to like try out millimeter wave 5G on, which, if you're not aware, is like the fastest, most immediately impressive kind of 5G, but it's extremely geographically limited.
You have to be looking at the 5G antenna basically to get those speeds. Yeah.
If you're not on the right street corner, like good luck. So I went to Bryant Park and I got 1.4 gigabits down, which is wild.
Okay.
Like,
that's good.
It stinks a little just knowing that, like, my home internet that I pay too much money for.
A lot more,
God. But the problem is some apps, some services aren't really optimized for it yet. Yeah. I tried downloading some videos off of Netflix over 5G millimeter wave, which doesn't seem to, at least for now, we're testing this a little bit early. The Netflix iOS app doesn't seem to, like, let you download at full speed.
Which is not like locked and optimized in a certain way, just so it doesn't kill your bandwidth normally. But
which is definitely possible. And and to be completely fair, this is we ran into this exact same issue when we tested Netflix on Android phones last year on 5G for the first time. Like, they just there are limiters in place for like quality of life stuff, and they just like didn't take it off yet, which is totally fair. Other stuff like the fact that iTunes still insists that you download over Wi-Fi, even though this internet is nine times nicer than my Wi-Fi. There are just a lot of little smoothing that has to happen for
it's
millimeter
really
wave to work.
And my solution for that, by the way, is try to connect another device to the 5G or something, which is harder with 5G, but then hotspot it to your phone.
It's
and
2020,
then
man. I should
it's
not have
much.
To do that.
Yeah. It's too much. It's funny that Apple didn't even update its own stuff to really take advantage of this, because those limits have been in place forever, right? They've slightly made it bigger. They've allowed for bigger apps and some slightly bigger media, but not as much as like, oh, I can get whatever the heck I want, you know, wherever I am.
Yeah.
Did you try Spotify, by the way? I seem to remember.
Oh, that. I did. Yeah. Yeah. I downloaded. So a couple things I tried in Spotify. I listened to a lot of podcasts. So an hour long podcast, which I think was about 60 megabytes or something like that, downloaded in under a second. So you just tap it and it's done, which is Beautiful. Kind of wild. Uh-huh. I think I follow the like lo-fi chill study playlist, which is like 6.5 hours of music.
Yeah.
That took 45 seconds to download. So
I love it.
There are situations like when carriers talk about 5G, they're like, yeah, you know, when you're on a plane getting ready to take off, like you can download everything you need to get before you even take off, which
That's
is
great.
True-ish.
Except That's, airports are always the worst for reception too.
Yeah. For like, one, airports, stable that's LTE never either. Going to happen.
Come on.
And then also just like the nature of 5G is such that millimeter wave is just one part of one carrier's rollout. And the other carrier I tried was T-Mobile, and they seem to have the most comprehensive approach so far. So they've got sub six everywhere. I believe they have some millimeter wave spots sort of around, but they're really cagey about telling you where they are.
Can you break down the difference between sub six and millimeter wave just quickly? Cause I know Sherlyn has talked about this a lot, but just as part of this conversation, what can we expect from these?
So 5G kind of boils down into two main flavors. Millimeter wave, which, as I've said, is much faster, but very, very geographically limited. Like you have to be more or less within line of sight of a millimeter wave node to really get that high performance. That's perhaps the more technically impressive right off the gate, but you're very unlikely to use that on a regular basis. You can't use it indoors. So like, don't pin too much of your hopes on that. You'll just randomly find it and it's nice. And then you walk away and it's gone. Mm-hmm. The rest of the carriers in the US rely more heavily on sub six 5G, which is just sort of slower. It's more or less comparable to LTE, generally a little faster.
It's still LTE. Like 5G is just it's an evolution of LTE, which is another evolution. But it's still basic LTE underlying everything, right?
It depends on the layout it depends on the rollouts we're talking about. So for Verizon, for instance, they went super heavy on millimeter wave. And then just recently, I think at the Apple event announced their nationwide 5G network was happening. T-Mobile, on the other hand, I think handled this a little bit better. They went whole hog with their low band and mid band 5G, which basically just gets you much broader coverage. So you'll maybe not see the biggest increase in speeds, but latency is generally a little better. You've got the extra sort of headroom for bandwidth there if you need it.
Better for rural areas too, right? Like coverage
theoretically
in other parts of America,
you will see 5G logos on phones in places like Iowa, for instance, but it's not going to make your coverage better, right? Like the coverage is just sort of different, and this is all pretty anecdotal because I haven't gone to Iowa or Michigan or any of those sort of other places that have primarily low band 5G. It's nice to have, but in those cases, it's not a game changer. It might become that over time, but right now you're still looking at, a couple signal bars at best, whatever speeds you were kind of getting before, not a huge difference.
I'm looking forward to trying out, especially because I'm in Georgia now, and sometimes if we go on a long road trip to the coast or something like to Savannah or other areas, you're driving through country highways, you're driving through areas without much normal LTE reception. So I'd love to see if 5G makes a difference there. Yeah.
What is your sort of coverage situation now like?
Pretty good. I mean, I'm in a suburb now that is basically a startup town. So there are startups everywhere. Like I can't escape them. And there's good LTE coverage.
Oh, so you've probably got that good home internet too, don't you?
I have good home internet. So I have gigabit now, which I'm very happy with. I have AT&T gigabit. And I just switched over from T-Mobile to Verizon LTE. And that's a whole long story. But Verizon in general has been more reliable in Georgia. So I decided to make the switch. I checked our 5G coverage map, though, really only in downtown Atlanta, like in some specific spots, like Georgia Tech and some other areas downtown. That's the only place you can get millimeter wave. And then again, you have to be basically looking at the tower to really get those speeds. Everywhere else is just like nothing. So that's what's really soured me on 5G a bit, I think, because if you're in Bryant Park, great. If you're spending the day working in Bryant Park, you're going to get these speeds, create a hotspot, share it with your friends. That's not where we are most of the time. We're moving and out and about, and 5G is not keeping up with
we
us.
We were moving, and we were out and about.
Well, we were moving. God.
So in some ways, if you think about it, the value of millimeter wave 5G is somewhat even reduced compared to that, because we're just not spending as much time out in the world. We're going into winter now. COVID is a thing. You know, it's going to be a while before anyone really kind of sees huge, huge practical benefits from 5G. But carriers had to lay the groundwork, and phone makers had really no choice but to get in on the wave.
Yeah. One more thing I want to ask you about. We're seeing high refresh rate screens on so many Android phones now. That, to me, is like the premium experience, because if you see a high refresh rate screen, if you see something beyond 60 hertz, it looks like butter. It is silky smooth, and we spend so much time doom scrolling. I want my doom scrolling to look the best it can. Come on. I'm not going to get that with the 12 Pro or the 12 Pro Max, which is kind of disappointing to me. What do you think?
Look, I really, really love these displays. I've been advocating them as soon as I saw the first one, which I think the first one I tried was like the Razer phone back in the day.
Yeah.
But obviously Apple didn't do that here. Whether or not that's a deal breaker for you is up to you. I think the challenge here is, you know, Apple had to integrate a 5G modem that they had not really worked with before. They had the A14 chipset, which is considerably more powerful, though also more power efficient. You've got screens kind of across the board that are better than what you got out of the 11 series last year. So, you know, there are a lot of concerns here that might make that impossible. That said, we did know kind of going into this, like at least some of Apple's prototypes had support for 120 hertz refresh rate. So at some point along the line, it seems like they just decided something's got to give here. The easiest thing to not do is 120 hertz. It sucks. I don't know that I wouldn't not buy an iPhone 12 or 12 Pro because of that. But I mean, at the same time, a lot of people out there who have fairly recent phones, if you're an iPhone 11 or 11 Pro person, just wait. Whatever happens next year is going to be so much better. This is the first wave of a new era at Apple. And that's great. And I understand exactly why people would want to be on that wave, because God knows I'm that kind of person too. But practically speaking, and I'm all about practicality these days, if you have
an
11 Pro...
Are you?
Yes.
I know you pretty well. Come on. Okay.
I'm a changed man, Devinder Hardwar.
There was one day where I was sitting next to you and you bought like a MacBook Pro for no reason. You didn't
need
it.
That's not true. Yeah. I can test this.
Yeah.
But point is, if you have an 11 or an 11 Pro, those phones are still so good that you do not need to think about upgrading to this. 5G be damned. Like, get another year or two out of your 11 or 11 Pro, the 5G situation is going to be better. You're going to feel more of what happens with the 8-15 or whatever chipset is available when you do decide to upgrade. You're in a good place and do not mess with that.
Would you expect a bigger redesign next year? Because this is kind of a slight redesign. We have the flatter edges. We have slightly bigger displays. I try to wait for the big refresh cycles, and This right now is the biggest one we've had since the iPhone 10 launch, you know, but we still have the crazy like the front notch.
Yeah.
We still have the notch.
Yeah, we thought those really got smaller too.
Because they're relying on Face ID, we can't get rid of it. So I want to get rid of the notch. Do you think that could happen next year, or is it going to be longer?
Look, man, it's possible. Like I cover Apple a lot. I have like no inside information as to what Apple does or does not do. But I will say that We're likely to see these designs stick around for a while. We're having these like flat pro inspired designs, this kind of classic iPhone 5 look. That's not going anywhere, I would imagine. So yeah, we will see Apple focus more on sort of the sort of more subtle elements of that design, including the notch. The big rumor going into this was that the notch would be smaller. That really didn't happen this time.
No. The 12 is really disappointing too, because it's like the notch is still big. It hasn't reduced itself proportionally to the size of the screen. So it's actually bigger on the 12 mini than on the 12 or the 12 Pro.
Yeah. And that's going to going to turn some people off. But the way I look at it, if you were like the kind of person who really cared about what the iPhone 12 mini brought to the table, like that's probably not going to turn you off. Like you're probably like a weird small phone person. And that's just like something you live with. Notches are interesting in that... They're objectively not good. Like no one would like to have a notch if they could avoid it.
And they've had the biggest notch for a long time.
Apple has not cared about making that thing smaller. Yeah. But at the same time, like maybe this is just because like I review the iPhones for Engadget. Like they just like I stopped noticing them like 2 years ago and I've just like never picked up on them again. So like, your mileage as like a regular consumer may completely vary, and that's cool.
If you're an Android head and you've been spoiled by like a nice tiny pinhole camera and everything, then yeah, this is going to feel like a step back to you. But my 11 Pro, I don't really, it's not a thing that bugs me, but I also don't sit back and watch a lot of video on my phone. I don't full screen a lot of stuff.
Oh, really?
Although, yeah, yeah. Well, what I do like now is the new, is the iOS 14, but the latest iOS, where now you could basically just flip up full screen video and turn it like into a little picture in picture window. Like that has been immensely useful for me. But beyond that, I don't really full screen video, you know. You got bigger screens for that. Come on.
Yeah, like my Galaxy Z Fold 2. Love that guy.
Or the Surface Duo that I have sitting here. Hey, TLDR, is the iPhone 12 worth it to you? Because to me, with the 11 Pro, it kind of isn't. But for my wife, who is trying to get into iOS and wants a small phone, the 12 mini looks like it'll be pretty hot. What about your perspective?
So you and I are real specific edge cases, yep. right? Like yep. we love the good stuff. And in a situation like that, one might say, you know, the Pro's probably fine. I'm again, sort of pulling a number out of nowhere, but for like 90% of people, especially if you have not upgraded your phone in 2 or 3 years, which is so much more common than it used to be. People are just holding on to phones. The iPhone 12 is more than enough for you. It's more than Pro enough for you. It's hard to justify a situation in which the iPhone 12 Pro is worth the extra $200 to $300. Mm-hmm. If you really, really care about the camera and sort of what Apple is going to do down the road, for example, with its new Pro RAW format, that might be a reason. But if you're a camera person at all, I would say do not buy any one of these right now. Wait a month until the iPhone 12 Pro Max comes out and we get to see what that thing can do on the camera front. Sure. Because I'm super excited to see where Apple went with that thing.
Excellent. Thank you, V. Okay, enough about the iPhone. Let's talk about things that really matter in the world right now, which is the election. That's 2 weeks away. And right now, everybody is doing their darndest to get people hyped up, get people, well, it's probably too late to register, but get people to actually vote, which is kind of the big thing. So one surprising thing we saw this week is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went on Twitch to play Among Us. And I thought this would just be kind of a fun, cool thing. She is so very good at social media. If you guys look at her, when she sits down on Instagram Live or something and she just plops her phone down in her kitchen while she's making food and just wants to discuss policy, it's really fascinating to see those numbers, the viewers go up really quickly. So clearly, like, I think as a politician, as like a young politician, she has a very good command of social communication. Twitch and Among Us seems like a perfectly, it's a funny way to kind of bring out the vote, because it's a game that's all about there's a lot of voting. You do a lot of voting in that game to figure out who the, you know, it's a game where you're a bunch of characters on a spaceship. It's basically Alien, right? Alien meets The Thing, where you're a bunch of characters. One of the people is an imposter that's, you know, disabling the ship and killing off people. And it's a social game where you have to basically pretend, you have to hide yourself if you are the imposter, or you have to try to figure out who it is. It's a great party game, and it was really fun to see her join up with Ilhan Omar, some top Twitch streamers like Pokimane. This feels like the future of political communication in a way, right? It's not just people on, you know, a telethon somewhere saying, please vote very earnestly. It is people geeking out and doing weird stuff on a Twitch stream while also trying to get rally people up to consider the power they have to participate in democracy. Ben, B, did you guys see any of this? Do you have any thoughts of this this whole stream? I watched a bunch of it. I found it really entertaining, but also like very educational and useful too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm pretty sure I only found out about this after it happened, because I'm an extremely not online person.
Wow. I'm very surprised. Yeah.
I can count on like one hand the number of times I've like watched a Twitch stream all the way through. Like, I don't know. It's just like not the way I've been like programmed to get my entertainment.
No, I hear you. And I never watch a Twitch stream all the way through. It's like a thing you pop in or leave on the background, because I feel like very few people are sitting there focused on the stream like we used to be with TV shows and movies, right?
Yeah, and that's like very much the frame of mind that I came from. So I missed this point is, and just sort of going through the conversations that were sort of had after the fact, like one did kind of get a sense of the appreciation that AOC and Ilhan Omar were able to tap into a group of people who normally, I mean, young people are, I don't have stats to back this up, but I think sort of anecdotally, it seems that younger generations are less inclined to vote. There's a tendency to become disillusioned with politics or to think that it does not matter to your life as a young person. So having two people in very prominent positions in Congress, just being able to get out there and talk to you in a way that sort of makes
sense. Where you are, yeah.
That you find entertaining, maybe more than anything. Like, it humanizes politics in a way that I don't think a lot of other things can.
I agree so much with what you said, V. I think that it was an incredibly effective bit of political communication. Probably the most effective thing that I've seen in a while. Like a period of years. What I saw in general was people who were low engagement being more engaged. Even people who were highly engaged were like, okay, this is awesome. Like, there was very little, like, absolute bile toward them. It was all like, oh, this is pretty cool that this happened. Really, if you're looking for any kind of like people bad mouthing them, you have to go like down partisan lines.
And also, you know what happened this week? I also saw the West Wing reunion on HBO Max, which is
oh man
a whole different generation you're targeting of like Get Out the Vote. Is the people who loved the West Wing 20 years ago and it's like, man, it's really great to see Martin Sheen back as President Bartlett.
It's targeting the parents of the people who would watch AOC play.
This is how you do it. You get the nostalgia hit for the older audience, and then you get like the kids and what the kids are into. And I feel like this two-pronged approach is pretty smart and pretty great. And the stream too is just, it's entertaining. It's not just people begging you to vote. It's watching AOC in her first match. She was like, I hope it's not too bad. She was the imposter. So she did not want to be. She talked about like the fact that she's not a very good liar. I believe she murdered somebody, then immediately reported herself, and it was all a big thing. But
she was like, "Oh, I can't kill Pokey. She's so nice."
stab. Yeah,
I think one of the things that made it most effective was the fact that both AOC and Ilhan Omar were really like, they weren't trying to front as like, oh yeah, you know, I'm going to be great at this, or, you know, whatever.
This is not the Conan O'Brien let's play video games thing, right? It is like people actually playing a game and being engaged in it. Yeah.
Yeah. But also seeing them maybe be a little bit confused and a little bit hapless. One of my favorite things was like the little things that AOC said kind of to herself, kind of just to the stream, where she's like, you know, I can't believe that like we've got this like advanced spaceship, but it still runs on fossil fuels. Like, wow.
Love it. Great job.
Like, that's just a fun thing for anyone to say on a stream, but also like, always be on message.
Always be on message. Also, they spent like 10 minutes, I think, setting up audio settings, which is what you will do for every goddamn stream. It's too real.
That's honestly why we're doing this stream, to let people see how silly it is sometimes.
It's all so
to get
silly.
This thing going.
Another thing I liked is Ilhan Omar. She was not like as featured in the stream because it was an AOC stream, but she did post her rig. And I just want to talk about that. And first of all, I love to see, this is just another form of engagement, right? It's sort of like saying, hey, look at, I am a nerd enough to have a system that's like this with an Intel Core i7 10700K CPU. That's a hot chip. A Zotac RTX 2060 Super. Pretty good. I do feel like for a lot of people, the 2070, you will get more mileage out of that, or the 3070 now. That's always a good mid-range card. But hey, 2060 Super, if you're not playing heavy-duty games, it's hard to go wrong with that. She has 32 gigabytes of Trident Z RGB RAM. I have that one too, actually. I have four sticks in my system, and they all kind of like in sync change color, which is just so unnecessary, but also so beautiful. So if you look in the screenshot of her photo or of her rig, you can see the lit up RAM. She has a Samsung 970 Evo 1 terabyte SSD. I actually just picked that up too. They list 6 terabytes of SSD storage. And this is where I feel like we need some political investigative journalism, because that seems a lot. And that seems like a little too much and kind of hard. Like, it would cost a lot. Like, I just spent, $200 to get 1 terabyte of NVMe storage. And that's about what you'd pay to get that amount. Like, if it's actually SSD, you could probably put together like 2.5-inch slightly slower SATA SSDs, right? And combine those as like a single SSD thing. I think this is actually just a hard drive, so somebody mistyped.
I just crunched the numbers on this. 6 terabytes of SSD storage would be like in the high 500s, maybe 600s, depending on what kind
of SSD too. Like, because NVMe is a little.
What
six,
kind of SSD? Yeah. And I'm even talking about like sales tax.
Yeah.
Like it, that would be an enormous amount.
That's
of
not
money.
Even that much compared to what SSD used to cost. But hey, anyway, Corsair, she was a H100, I believe that is her power supply, in an NZXT H510i case. So like, it's a cool looking system. But I also sort of love that she is a notable politician right now who's just like, here, look at my specs, deal with it. Kind of hot. I dig that a lot. Anything else you guys want to add around this news?
What politician do you think would be Team AMD?
Because
I'm an AMD guy. I've not got the best system in the world, but I've got like a solid like Ryzen 7 3700X.
Like a very specific kind of technocrat would be AMD.
Like a Pete Buttigieg?
Like a PDP.
Buttigieg, yeah. Team AMD.
PDP. You'd be like, listen, my multi-core performance is so much better than yours, Ilhan Omar.
But that is so Andrew Yang.
It is very Andrew Yang. That's a Andrew Yang move, yeah. And he'd be like, listen, if you can survive on $1,000 a month, listen, the AMD is certainly better. You need these specs just like you need... an easy $1,000 a month. I don't know. If you missed out on this stream, by the way, go check out the Washington Post put up a great edit of the best moments from this Among Us stream. So go check that out. You can actually just still go watch the whole stream on AOC's Twitch channel too. So that's all. It's all great. Go check it out and let us know what you think at podcast@engadget.com. So some breaking news as we were putting the show together, there was a report from the Wall Street Journal that Quibi, the wonderful short form mobile video service, would be shutting down. Late last night before we recorded, Quibi confirmed it. Jeffrey Katzenberg confirmed he is in the process of shutting down the company. So let's just talk a bit about this because I feel like we've devoted some time to Quibi. Go back and check out my review of Quibi when it launched in April. I believe the title was like, stop trying to make Quibi happen, because it was a weird mobile video service, guys. And now I could talk about it in the past tense, so I feel it feels even better to me. But we talked to them at CES. We have a lot of coverage around Quibi. Their core technology was this thing where you could watch a video in portrait mode, turn to landscape mode, and still like the video would be optimized for both ways. So they were actually sending you both video streams, and they had a lot of good short form content too that was like 5 to 10 minutes long. They poured a lot of money into it. They raised around $1.7 billion, and I think we're in the process of getting even more. So nearly $2 billion worth of actual money was pumped into this crappy video startup in an age where countless people are unemployed. Our economy has collapsed. Like, Quibi just seemed like maybe it was unfair to target it as much as we did, but I don't think it was a good service. I think most of the content was not great. And I think Jeffrey Katzenberg's bet on, hey, I only want to watch video on my phone and I want people to pay for it, and it's going to be a quick bite. So that's what Quibi stands for. So you can consume it easily. I don't think any of those calculations actually rang true. And actually, I brought that up to him and CEO Meg Whitman directly at CES, and they were like, they kind of skated over my question of like, why the hell does this exist? And we're just like, we think this will be a third thing people will pay for alongside Netflix and their cable subscriptions and everything. And I was just completely incredulous. So in the shutdown confirmation, Katzenberg basically admitted they just couldn't make this concept work. Almost like something a lot of us were saying. Thoughts on Quibi, everybody.
I'm curious, Dev. I want your take on sort of what you think really killed Quibi. Was it a bad idea combined with bad execution, or did coronavirus play a significant role in this? Because you think about it, they want you to use Quibi like standing in lines when you're waiting to get into a movie or whatever, like these very quick hit scenarios that just like don't exist anymore.
Sure.
So what do you think is more worthy of blame?
Quibi launched in early April, right? Which was at the point where we were already in lockdown. We were already like getting used to our new pandemic reality. And Quibi was just not built for that world, I guess. But I don't think that was the thing that killed it. I think fundamentally it's a flawed concept. Specifically, I don't think people this is a thing where I think media titans, especially people like Katzenberg, who've been in the Hollywood industry for so, so long and have made billions of dollars, you know, for several companies, they think their ideas, everything they think is gold. In this case, they were trying to push consumers and push user habits into a thing where I don't think it's actually the way people live and work and enjoy their content. I don't think we were walking around, even if there was no pandemic, I don't think you'd be waiting in line, just popping up a video to watch an episode of something, or if you were on the train or something. Like, I don't think that's not the way we live. And that's not the way a lot of people enjoy video. Maybe some people would do that, but it's not like a dedicated thing. The worst part is Quibi bet it all on mobile. They had no way to pipe it to your TV, or they had no way to like share it and enjoy it with other people. So both of those things also killed it too, right? Like, they eventually added Chromecast support, but that wasn't there at launch. They eventually added, you know, the ability for more people to see what you're doing, but it was all... I remember just trying to watch an episode of one of the dumb Quibi shows with my wife, and we had to crowd around my phone, and our 55-inch OLED was sitting right in front of us, just going unused. Like, it just seemed fundamentally dumb. And I think my big takeaway from all this, I don't think mobile video as a concept should exist. And we've seen so many companies try. Hey, Verizon tried it. Go 90, everybody. Quibi is yet another, like, play at this. I think we want content that adapts to us. And I think forcing your audience to adapt to content is a mistake people keep making over and over and over again. So the flexibility of podcasts or YouTube, or even where right now you can watch YouTube on your phone, it'll sync to your account, you can keep watching at home. If you have YouTube Premium, you can actually download specific videos to your devices, which is super useful for me on car rides, so my daughter can see Peppa Pig wherever she is. That flexibility is where we're at. Netflix, Hulu, everybody's offering offline downloads now. You can watch that stuff on TVs, on multiple devices. We want flexibility. We want convenience. That's what consumers have always wanted. And this is the history of media, by the way. Like, Betamax was a better format than VHS. The video looked better, and TV stations for years relied on Betamax for archival video. But to bring it home, it was too expensive. It was too clunky. So VHS ended up winning out. What's another one? HD DVD and Blu-ray were kind of like fighting neck and neck. And I think in many ways, HD DVD was better, but Blu-ray had a bigger push from Sony. It had like more of an industry push. And eventually, like, they just made that work better too. So HD DVD died off. That was probably, I guess, another thing, because that wasn't just convenience, but it's the iPod thing. It's how the iPod killed portable CD players and portable music players. It is convenience trumps quality. And that's the thing we got to realize. And Quibi just seemed like a weird play that didn't fit into anybody's life, really, even without the pandemic.
Two things I want to jump in with. One, you look at the history of media format wars and sort of what wins and what doesn't, Sony is on the losing end of those so many times. It's really sad.
It's kind of funny too, by the way, because 4K Blu-ray is another one. And I will never stop bringing up the fact that the PlayStation 4 Pro has no 4K Blu-ray player, even though that's something the Xbox One S and the Xbox One X launched with. So Sony can't even support its own stuff. But go ahead, V.
Yeah, no, I was just casting my mind back to Minidisc versus cassette, because, like, recording quality, Minidisc, clear winner, but, like, they were just expensive and sort of cool and niche, and no one really bought them. But anyway, the other thing is, like, I don't think the Quibi idea was necessarily terrible. Even now, I still think the idea of having a video or two video streams that sort of are optimized for however you happen to be holding your device is a cool idea. But none of that matters when the content was terrible, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what was the runaway hit on Quibi, if anything? The Titus Burgess show where they blew up food and made people try to recreate it based on tasting?
There was no runaway hit. And the only the thing is, like, there was no way to make a runaway hit because you couldn't share stuff and content easily. So, like, the one thing that became viral was the, like, Sam Raimi short about the woman with the golden arm.
Bury me with my golden arm.
Yeah, that became a meme. But also, people were making fun of it for the wrong reason, because it's Sam freaking Raimi making something campy, but they're like, look at how terrible this Quibi show is. And that's unfair to Sam Raimi and to the content, but it's the fact that the blood was in the water for Quibi, right? Nobody could take it seriously. So this one thing that went viral, Of course, it went viral negatively. It's no surprise there.
I will say, it does feel a little bittersweet to have Quibi go south on us now, as I've just started testing the LG Wing, the only phone that Quibi makes sense on. For those unaware, it's the phone with sort of a, you know, you pull out of the box and it's a regular looking smartphone, but then you flip the screen so it rotates 90 degrees. So it is literally the only phone that is completely and perfectly optimized for Quibi use. I tried it yesterday. I paid $5 to Quibi just as like a send-off gift. And it works great, but God bless them, that content is bad. Ugh.
Were you able to see both feeds at once?
Not at once, but like it switches very nicely when you sort of swivel the screen.
The switch is basically, it assumes you're turning the device. So
yeah, exactly. Quibi works, it's purely mechanical.
Verizon missed out because that was the Go 90 phone, you know?
Oh, man. The,
that's what Go 90 meant, everybody. Go 90 meant you turned your phone 90 degrees. Anyway, one thing I've heard from a lot of people is that they assumed that Quibi was basically a play for Jeffrey Katzenberg to generate a lot of content, you know, get a lot of funding, because that's what he's very good at. And Hollywood is thirsty, completely thirsty. They want this new media thing. They want to get in on the next YouTube or something, or the next Netflix. So they VCs poured a ton of money into this company. Production companies like came up around it. And I don't blame people for trying to get that Quibi money and trying to make their shows, because there are a lot of good show ideas that I think ended up here. But it seemed like as a service was just a play for Katzenberg to eventually sell to Disney or to somebody else. And I want to throw a shout out to one thing. If you like the concept of mobile video, I wrote up something several months ago called What If I, one word, What If I, it's choose your own adventure mobile video. I feel like that was a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed watching those things, because it's basically a choose your own adventure book in mobile video form. So in key points of those movies, you're making choices, you have multiple endings to go through. There's like a map. Once you complete a session, there's a map of like which ending you got to and how you can get to different sections. That's fun and interactive and mobile. And at that point, I didn't care. I couldn't easily push it to my TV. So I don't think mobile video is dead, but it's not going to look like Quibi. It's not going to look like Go 90. It's probably going to look a little more like something like What If I. That's free right now, I think, for testing on iPhone. You can try it out. So that's pretty cool. So long, Quibi. I don't think we'll miss you, but I will miss making fun of you. All right, let's move on to what we've been working on. I'm testing out a microphone that I can't really talk about, but you'll learn more about that next week. I'm also doing lots of logistics prep just as I like prepare for, I don't know, reviewing the Xbox Series X and the PlayStation 5, which will probably be incoming soon. Those things are being released, you know, in early, mid-November, so 2 days across from each other. So woof. It's going to be a crazy next couple of weeks. We are going to be all in on testing these new consoles. Be sure to check out our previews. Jess Condit has done some great previews of the Xbox Series X. I'm personally interested in seeing where the Series S lines up, just because that's an interesting device. It's really cheap and really fascinating with Xbox Game Pass and everything. V, what are your next-gen console plans?
You know what? It's a question of proper allocation of resources, because I feel like I could spend the money for a PS5, which is I think I would gravitate towards, or I could just like put that towards trying to find a 3080 or a 3070 and just like really going all in on making good as it could be.
That's a much, much bigger thing, because then if you're putting the 3080 into a rig, then your build is all of a sudden like upward nearly $2,000, you know, if you go all in with everything else. So I feel like that's the thing, and a lot of people are gonna have to think about, like, do you want a new console, or do you want to like beef up a PC? There's still very big price gaps, but the performance gap between them is kind of being erased eventually. So it'll be exciting. New console time is always a really interesting time of year. V, what are you working on?
Whenever I do reviews, I tend to let my life fall into shambles, and I did the Pixel 5 and then moved directly into the iPhones. So my apartment is a disaster. So priority number one is doing my dishes and just cleaning everything. But once I'm done that, I'll be working on my review of the LG Wing, the perfect Quibi phone, which I'm going to make tons of jokes about, and just make sure that LG and this phone get the attention that it deserves, because God bless them. This phone is kind of ridiculous in a fun way.
Yeah. I feel like we say this about every single LG phone. Like every year, it's like, what fresh hell is this? It's a LG. Did you just put a second phone, a second screen on another side of a case, and you're calling it a dual screen phone? Okay, LG, fine.
Respect to them, though. They've got this whole initiative called the Explorer Project, and they have told me point blank, even if the LG Wing effing fails, even if no one buys it. They're still committed to the idea of just like trying new, interesting things and seeing if they can make money out of them. That's not a level of experimentation that you're going to see from a lot of smartphone makers. So I have to hand it to them for that.
Yeah, yeah, most definitely. Okay, well, looking forward to that. Be sure to check out Chris's reviews of the iPhone 12 and the 12 Pro, and I'm sure more will be coming. Yeah, this guy, you need a break too. Like now that Trillin has taken her break, so B needs his vacation.
Yeah, we've timed it out. She goes, and then I'll go at some point.
All right, let's move on to our pop culture picks for this week. I just wanted to shout out to Gangs of London on AMC Plus, which is a new show by Gareth Evans, the director of a couple cool movies called The Raid and The Raid 2 Redemption. This is him. What's really funny about this guy as a director is that he's a British guy who went to Indonesia to start making martial arts movies. And now he basically came back to the UK to do this series. It's a typical like crime family drama thing. It's kind of like Succession in a way, actually another show I love. But what's great about it is that this guy knows how to shoot fight scenes. So you will see some of the most brutal action sequences and choreography that you've ever seen on TV, and certainly more so than most movies in this show. There's one fight scene where a guy basically takes out like 10 people with a throwing dart from a bar, just like really using that dart in like a really fun way. And if you like to see bones crunching on the edges of tables, if you want to see like all sorts of fun stuff like that, I always love Gareth Evans movies because of that. So be sure to check this out. The problem with Gangs of London, by the way, is that it requires yet another streaming service called AMC Plus. And I did the Homer Simpson thing where there's a scene where he just like opens an email and just goes like he's about to say, you know, a swear word, because nobody needs another streaming service. I didn't realize. I thought this was just coming to AMC. No, you need to subscribe to AMC Plus, and you could do that through the Apple TV thing or through Amazon or whatever. It's actually not in a separate app right now. It just really annoys me because I was already paying for Sling TV. I got AMC on that. I don't know why I had to pay for something else for more AMC. I don't think anybody's going to watch the show because of what they did with it. But hey, eventually when it heads to Amazon Prime or Netflix or something, like maybe it's a thing people will watch. But yeah, it's really cool. If you dug the Raid movies, I think you'd probably enjoy this. V, what do you want to shout out this week?
I have been, so as many, many local news anchors have insisted to us for the past few weeks, it is spooky season. Halloween is nearly upon us, and therefore spooky season. So I felt after writing my iPhone reviews and just being a little brain dead for a while, I needed something kind of scary to kind of jolt me back into life again. So I landed on House, a 1977 film directed by Nobuhiko Obayashi. It's a Criterion
collection.
Yes. So you know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
So it's available on HBO Max. It is a real fever dream of a movie. Long story short, there's like seven girls who, long story short, go to one of the girls' aunt's house for like a little summer break to have a good time. And it turns out the house is demonic and there's like an evil cat involved and the house eats people.
Love it.
Like some of the stylistic choices, like I'm not nearly as big a movie person as Javindra, but like sitting down and watching the first few minutes of this film, which are just completely bad.
I don't know if you were mentally prepared for this movie, but yeah.
I was like, oh, I've heard of this. I should watch this. Yeah. I'll finally get down to it. And oh my God, none of it was what I was expecting it to be.
Nope.
It's very poppy and stylish in a way that I didn't expect. But then also just like veers into total hallucination territory. It's wild and it's a lot of fun.
I love hallucination horror. It's a movie I enjoy more than like the original Suspiria, which I know there are a lot of Dario Argento fans out there, but I find Suspiria kind of boring. House is a blast and kind of fun. So anyway, if you want more chill horror stuff, I recommended The Haunting of Bly Manor a couple of weeks ago, which Sherlyn was super into. If you want a show that will both kind of scare you and also break your heart, that is so good. So Haunting of Bly Manor, everybody. Celebrate Halloween with that, too. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter. I podcast about movies and TV at the/filmcast, slashfilm.com. Check out my Legend of Korra podcast, Republic City Dispatch. Just Google that. It was really great to bring back that crew. Podcasting all the shows, all the movies. And V, where can we find you online?
If you want to reach out, I am Chris Velasco on Twitter, or, and I get flack for this every time, you can email me at v@engadget.com.
Why would you do this? But okay. Yeah.
I get good stuff. People are pretty chill about it.
You can email us at the podcast at podcastengadget.com. And we did actually get a couple of emails I didn't get to this week. But thank you for everybody who's been chiming in. We'll try to bring up some emails during the show if you communicate with us. So, yeah, do that, please. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe to us on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.